Good afternoon. I'm Jenny He. I'm a curatorial assistant in the Department of Film and one of the co-organizers of the Tim Burton exhibition, along with assistant curator Ron Magliozzi and Raj Roy, the Celeste Bartos Chief Curator of Film. I will present on the films of Tim Burton, and Ron will present on the gallery exhibition. Just by a show of hands quickly, how many of you have been up to the gallery exhibition? Okay, great. So then it's about half and half. We'll certainly touch upon things that you may have seen that we won't have slides for, and then we'll also go into details on works that you did see or you may not have seen if you did not visit the show. As part of the exhibition, we are presenting all of Tim's feature films in the theaters in 35mm prints to give audiences a chance to see films such as 1985's Pee Wee's Big Adventure or Edward Scissorhands from 1990. As most generations haven't seen these films in the theaters, they came to know and love Edward Scissorhands, the iconic character from maybe television or VHS, and certainly now DVD. Before we go into Tim's features, wanted to touch upon his professional shorts. Tim worked as an apprentice animator at Disney from 1980 to 1984. During this time, he was given the opportunity to make several short films. The first from 1982 is Vincent, which is a stop-motion animated short film about a lonely suburban boy who imagines himself to be a tragic mad scientist. It was narrated by Vincent and recited in verse very much akin to the Nightmare Before Christmas poem that Tim started with before it was made into the feature. This 1982 black and white short film had a lot of German expressionistic characteristics that Tim took from his childhood watching films such as Nosferatu or The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. These stylistic influences will follow Tim throughout his career. We'll point this out later. His second short film, made for the Disney Channel in 1983, was a reimagining of Hansel and Gretel, featuring an all-Asian cast with some nods to Godzilla as well as martial arts films. According to legend, and as try as we might, we have not been able to verify this other than verbal accounts, this film aired on the Disney Channel at midnight on Halloween. And for the Disney Channel, it was basically infomercial time. It had not been seen since until we brought it to our gallery exhibition. It is currently running upstairs in its entirety. And when we went to find the film, Disney did not have a copy. Tim himself did not have a copy. We had to go to his collaborators who worked on the film and reconstitute the movie based on several generations of video material, beta material from the original production, and VHS copies taped off of the television when it aired. So this is definitely a find, and if you have an opportunity to see the show before we close on April 26th, definitely make a beeline for that. His last short that he made for Disney was Frankenweenie, which is from 1984, and it imagines Dr. Frankenstein's monster in the form of a reanimated beloved family pet. This was live action, and it starred Shelley Duvall and Daniel Stern, but Tim had always wanted to make it as a stop-motion animated feature, and he is now getting the opportunity to do so. He is remaking his Frankenweenie, set to be released next year as a feature-length stop-motion animated film, following the footsteps of course, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas and Corpse Bride from 2005. Just a little side note about Tim's influences. He grew up watching the films of Ray Harryhausen, Jim Danforth, and he fell in love with stop-motion animated, the technique. And coincidentally, he was a classmate of John Lasseter's at Cal Arts, where he studied in the late 70s, and they were colleagues at Disney in the early 80s. And of course, you all know that Toy Story was the first completely computer animated feature film, which came out in 1995. So while John was going to infinity and beyond with computer animation, Tim went back to the roots of filmmaking and sort of revitalize, re-energize this medium of stop-motion animation. And of course, this past year, we saw Wes Anderson's The Fantastic Mr. Fox made in stop-motion animation and Henry Selick's Coraline. So this film technique that was pioneered in the late 1800s is still alive and strong. And I think, and I truly believe that 1993's The Nightmare Before Christmas had a large part in keeping this medium alive. So going into Tim's feature films, his first feature was 1985's Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which he made when he was 26 years old. Paul Rubens saw Frankenweenie and gave the young director a chance. And Tim was able to put a lot of his now recurring motifs into that film. If you remember the film, it opens with an elaborate kind of Rube Goldberg-esque morning routine. And of course, that recurs in Tim's later films. So it's just one of the many ways in which Tim began to have his specific imprint, which later on, as he developed as a filmmaker, these specific imprints became known as Burton-esque. At the end, there is a montage throughout Warner Brothers' backlot, and Tim grew up in Burbank, California, in the shadows of these film studios. So that was a specific, especially personal touch for Tim. His next film was 1988's Beetlejuice, written by Michael McDowell, who Tim would later work on Nightmare Before Christmas with. Beetlejuice, again, has certain German expressionistic stylistic points. If you remember, when they go through the underworld, the Maitlands are walking through kind of this lopsided hallway, no right angles, and very much a dreamlike quality. In 1989, Tim re-energized the Batman franchise, and he was able to cast Michael Keaton as Batman, more of a cerebral, witty superhero character, and he actually had to fight to cast Michael Keaton in this film because Warner Brothers wanted a more muscular, a more iconic superhero, but Tim fought for Michael Keaton and was able to make Batman his own, kind of positioning the superhero in this Gotham City, in this world that could not exist. And if you're familiar with Tim's films, he is very much a visual filmmaker who positions his characters in these worlds that exist only in the imagination. In 1990, Tim was able to make his passion project, which Edward Scissorhands, which is to date one of his most autobiographical films. Edward Scissorhands started off as a sketch that Tim did, and he gave this sketch to Caroline Thompson, the screenwriter, and said, please write a screenplay based on this sketch. And Caroline was able to take the sketch that Tim did, which evoked the loneliness and the persecution that Edward Scissorhands would feel in the film, and fashioned a screenplay based on all these emotions that came out of this sketch. Later on, Ron will talk specifically about Tim's concept art and Tim's drawings, but just wanted to give you a hint of how Tim takes his drawings from a work on paper and its transition to the screen. In 1992, he followed up with Batman Returns, which featured very much sympathetic villains in the form of Catwoman and the Penguin. Just to touch upon Tim's love for holidays, when he was growing up in Burbank, California, he couldn't find creativity from without. The only time that his environs were enlivened was during the holidays, Halloween, Christmas time, when his neighbors would decorate their lawns and houses. And of course, this plays a prominent role in Edward Scissorhands, and as well as Nightmare Before Christmas, and specifically also in Batman Returns, when the Penguin is born and abandoned during Christmas time. And of course, Catwoman was made into a villain by the evilness of her employer. So all of this touches upon Tim's love for the sympathetic monsters. He grew up watching Universal's horror movies. Of course, the most iconic sympathetic monster is Dr. Frankenstein's monster in James Whale's 1931 film Frankenstein. And that you'll see, of course, in Edward Scissorhands, as well as his other films in which there are these reluctant villains who are perhaps, they're certainly, you know, anti-heroes in the form of Jack Skellington in The Nightmare Before Christmas, but they are also reluctant in that they were made evil by the actions of others. Sweeney Todd is another example. Tim is attracted to these projects because of these characters that resonate with him. As a young child, growing up in high school, he had these very specific themes that he subconsciously connected with. And you'll see that throughout all of his work. And that is one of the reasons why he has an altruist imprint in all of his films, because you can recognize, perhaps consciously or maybe subconsciously, all these themes that make a film, a Tim Burton film. So just to go quickly through Tim's films in the 1990s, he next made Ed Wood, which is a biographical picture on the worst director of all time, B-movie maker Ed Wood. And although, you know, by all accounts, Ed Wood's films were horrible, Tim's film is about the tenacity of creativity and about a director, a filmmaker, whose work completely stank but still would not give up. And of course, you have Bela Lugosi, played by Martin Landau, in the form of this revered father who ultimately disappoints. And that is another recurring character archetype in all of Tim's films, where the protagonist looks up to this father figure who does not come through for the protagonist. But however, the protagonist is hell-bent on clinging to this hope. Then Mars Attacks, Tim went a completely different route, and it came out in 1996, a few months after Independence Day, if you remember that film, which was a blockbuster action movie. And Mars Attacks was received not so well, probably because it was released in the same year as Independence Day. Mars Attacks was an homage and a parody of the 1970s disaster flicks such as The Poseidon Adventure, The Towering Inferno, The Swarm, where you had all these A-list actors being killed off one by one by these horrible natural disasters. And Tim, of course, grew up loving these movies, so Mars Attacks was, in a way, an homage to those films, as well as the 1950s science fiction movies such as Invaders from Mars, 20 Million Miles to Earth. And it wasn't received very well because it wasn't marketed as that kind of a film. It was marketed as an action film, and also the proximity to Independence Day kind of diminished how audiences received it. Sure. That is Beetlejuice, and Ron will talk about the entrance to the exhibit in a sec, but the teeth that is at the entrance is actually based on Trick or Treat, which is an unrealized project that Tim did for Disney in 1980. In 1999, Tim did Sleepy Hollow, which is, of course, based on Washington Irving's short story, and we'll talk more in depth about that in a sec. And then 2001, Tim did Planet of the Apes, which you see in the lower left. And then, of course, Big Fish in 2003. And then 2005, Tim did two films, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Corpse Bride. And then in 2007, Tim adapted Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd into a film starring Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. And speaking of adaptations, we move into Tim's latest film, Alice in Wonderland. And before I wrap up, I just want to talk a little bit more in depth about adaptations. If you look at Tim's career as a whole, you'll see that he often adapts from popular stories, popular films, and popular novels and books. And in a way, Tim is attracted to adaptations because he's able to subvert expectations. His art is about taking what is perceived and turning it on its head. Just to give you a little anecdote, one time we asked Tim why he wears striped socks, because he wears striped socks often and you see stripes in all of his films and artwork. And he said that stripes actually ground him. And he finds what other people might find dizzying or kind of unnerving to be grounding. And Tim also finds monsters to be the characters who make more sense than the normal humans. Of course, Corpse Bride comes to mind, where the underworld actually makes more sense and is livelier and more attractive than the dreary, normal living world. So for adaptations, Tim is able to take something that everyone recognizes and is familiar with, and then creating it into his own by subverting your expectation of the story. Of course, Alice was made into this very much girl power story, where she goes back and she rescues everyone from Underworld. And here's another example of adaptation. Tim takes, you know, everybody knows the Clement Clark Moore poem, "The Night Before Christmas." So Tim uses that as a jumping point and creates this world that is completely unexpected, where Halloween Town might take over Christmas Town. And of course, Nightmare Before Christmas from 1993 is now very much ingrained in popular culture and is yet another example of how Tim is able to take something, subvert it, and that is now has now become the norm. Mars Attacks, I don't know if how many of you know, was actually adapted from Topps trading cards from 1960s. The screenwriter came to Tim one day with these trading cards, and Tim instantly saw a film from these trading cards, and he created his own irreverent take on these very simple trading cards that kind of blended into obscurity from the 60s, but he was able to take it and revitalize it. And then the next adaptation that I want to talk about is Planet of the Apes. What attracted Tim to this film mostly was the fact that the idea of talking apes. And he wanted to do a movie in which apes talked. And that was his only reason for remaking Franklin Schaffner's 1968 film. And of course, it wasn't well received, and it certainly isn't the best of Tim's films. But I wanted to bring this up as an example because a lot of people wonder why Tim chose to remake this classic. And the reason is because Tim wanted to take something that is unexpected and make it his own. Batman is, of course, another example of that. As I mentioned before, he transformed the superhero from this kind of dark, gothic, noirish superhero to this kind of funny, witty, cerebral, everyday man who, you know, is as quick with a joke as he is with a weapon or a gadget. And then lastly, second to last, this is Sleepy Hollow. He transformed the priggish school teacher into this forensic scientist. He took Washington Irving's well-known short story and turned it into a supernatural tale. I don't know if you're familiar with the short story, but it's quite ambiguous whether or not the ghost in the story is actually a ghost or perhaps a figment of Ichabod Crane's imagination. However, Tim takes this and creates this Grand Guignol-esque supernatural whodunit with a very intellectual Ichabod Crane, intellectual and squeamish. And the last adaptation that I wanted to speak about is Willy Wonka. Of course, everyone is familiar with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but for Tim's adaptation, he added Dr. Wilbur Wonka, adding a backstory to Willy Wonka's upbringing. And Wilbur Wonka is another example of the revered father who disappoints. He, if you're familiar with Tim's film, Dr. Wonka, who is a dentist, is completely against candy, and it is this opposition that drives Willy Wonka to create the best candy factory in the world. And at the end, Willy Wonka had to find redemption by reconciling with his father. And of course, if you've seen the film, Tim transformed it visually into his own, and this is just a shot from the movie, giving you an example. If you've seen the Mel Stewart film with Gene Wilder, it's a completely different take in Tim's version. And at the core of it, of course, Tim is a visual filmmaker, and we'll move into the gallery exhibition portion of the retrospective, where if you've seen the exhibition, you know that Tim is certainly a visual artist. So I'll turn it over to Rob Magliozzi.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. Why Tim Burton? Many people have asked us, or a number of people have asked us. For some people, why Tim Burton is a no-brainer. For other people, why Tim Burton at MoMA is a big question. The Department of Film has been doing gallery exhibitions on the cinema, in fact, since 1939, when we opened the main building. We've done over 80 exhibitions. We started with Georges Méliès, and before Burton, the big exhibition that we did was Pixar. One of the answers to that question is we've been doing it for a long time. It's our mandate to bring film into the context with the other curatorial departments, painting and sculpture, architecture and design. Our traditional galleries are the theaters, but as I said, we've been doing gallery exhibitions on filmmakers, as you know, if you've gone to the Titus One or Two theaters for many years. We moved into the new building in 2004. There was a lot more real estate to fill, and they offered us larger exhibition space. That was the next step forward. And the first big show we did, as you may well know, was Pixar. It was a Pixar exhibition. And at that time, they asked us what would be the follow-up. And you know, I actually thought Pixar was CGI film. It was John Lasseter. It was CalArts, where he had gone to school when Tim went to school. And Tim is also CalArts. They both worked at Disney. And Tim was stop motion as an animator. Tim was the other side of the equation. That's why Tim Burton came to him. And also, 2005, he did those two films, a stop motion film and a live action film together. He's always doing stop motion, live action. He did Alice. He's doing Frank and Weenie as a stop motion film now, as his next film. So there's the Monster Mouth entrance. And here's the answer to the question of what inspired it. This drawing from the early 80s for a Trick or Treat. So we were offered the third gallery's space. We were offered that long hall. The first thing we decided to do was close off the windows and create an environmental entry to the space. The show actually begins with a chronology on the wall, which is important for us because we really wanted to put the films in the context of the other art in the show. This slideshow is basically takes you through the exhibition, and I'll probably just click through this. Most of you have seen the show rather than discussing each piece. This is from the black light space. They wanted to organize the exhibition as an art exhibition. And actually, I spent a lot of time looking at the films, and then I forgot about them. The gallery exhibition is not about the films. That may seem strange to say. It's about the art. We organized it as an art exhibition intentionally. In terms of the way it's mounted, in fact, I made an effort to mimic some of the other curatorial departments. Part of the Burton exhibition looks like a drawings exhibition, part of it looks like a P&S exhibition. The final part with the platform is meant to represent to make the A&D an A&D installation. Tim's collaborations with us, people have asked that too. There were 550 pieces of art from Tim Burton's private archive, most of which people have never seen in the exhibition. The remaining pieces that bring us up to 716 come from studio archives, props and costumes, and also these pieces that Tim created specifically for the exhibition. This is the way that Tim really engaged us, was when he created these pieces for the show. He came to the galleries in July after we'd made our initial selection for the exhibition, and walked through the gallery space, looked at what we'd chosen, and proposed creating seven new installation pieces: Balloon Boy in the atrium, Robot Boy, this black light carousel, knowing that we had a black light space. They're all based on art that's in the exhibition. So we found a lot of work that Tim, as I said, most of the work in the show, as in Pixar, people had never seen before. And that was a coup for us to be presenting so much work that no one had ever seen. And Tim is, as you well know from Jenny, a filmmaker, not a gallery artist. So we're taking a filmmaker's work and bringing it into a gallery. And that's why people have said to us, why Tim Burton in a gallery? Tim did not intend the work to be exhibited in a gallery. A lot of it doesn't have titles. It's a challenge. It hadn't been exhibited before, so when the work hasn't been exhibited, you don't know how big it is, when it was made necessarily, if you don't film it, you didn't make note of that. We identified, after looking at the films, before we looked at the art, I identified a number of made visual motifs. The motifs in Tim's work, not all visual, some of them are narrative. I'll point them out when we get to them. Body modification, bod mod, as I called it. You know, there's a lot of piercing, severed heads, exaggerated bodies, people in moments of transformation or stress. This is art from Tim did in the early 80s, during the period before he had a career as a filmmaker. Around the time he was working at Disney, he spent a lot of time experimenting with squash and stretch. The Carnival of Alaska is another theme in Tim's work. That is the festive nature of the grotesque, you know, the Day of the Dead, the question marks, stripes, pumpkins, clown motifs, circus motifs, carnival motifs that appear in Tim's work are examples of the Carnival of Alaska. This is an example of our lunatic salon style, as the critic from Film Comments said, which I took as a compliment because I intended it to be kind of lunatic. We had a lot of work to present. We had 550 pieces, and the way to put it in an exhibition was to do something like this. I actually, at one point, wanted to have floor-to-ceiling art, and I wanted people to ride on, like, you know, those kind of cranes they use to install things, to look at the art. That was never going to be possible, but that was kind of the idea of it. And the other point of installing like this is to show, this all comes from roughly from the same period, except for the large pieces. The blue girl with the wine bottle in the middle, a large painting, is later, to demonstrate that he continues to explore these motifs. One reason for installing like this was to show that this is burst of creativity in certain periods of his life. And there is a kind of chronology to the exhibition if you've been to it. If you turn to the left as you come in, you encounter this, what I call somewhat more mature work, and then you go into the green area, which is the juvenilia, and as you walk through, you end up in the darker area, which is his mature work as an artist. So you go from a period of the surviving Burbank period, when Tim is a disaffected teenager in Burbank, California, and turns to comedy, basically to comedy and horror films. Comedy and horror as an alternative. Comedy in cartoons, Mad Magazine. He didn't like comic books, actually. He clipped, you know, comics from magazines. Greeting cards, he loved greeting cards, so his scrapbooks are full of greeting cards. There are a few in the exhibition. And to horror, humor and horror. This is the other thing he turned to, as Jenny talked about his interest in horror films and science fiction films. And he organized film series when he was a teenager and a little bit older for the Burbank Police Athletic League, youth band he belonged to. Tim's dad was in the Burbank, worked for the Burbank's Department of Recreation, was a football coach. His mother ran a little boutique called Cats Plus. She sold cat collectibles. If you think of Tim's work, you can see the influence of both of them. So Tim was in the youth band. Tim was a kind of typical kid, but he was very bored and very disaffected. So we turned to these things. humor and comedy, humor and horror. At 17, his first, we look, recognize this is his first professional acknowledgement of his talent, is this sign, this trash truck sign. He entered a contest to beautify Burbank as a 17-year-old kid, and he won. His art was put on the side of the trash trucks. These signs, these holes are actually where it was, you know, screwed into the truck. And this is in the exhibition, and they traveled around Burbank. The art on it resembles a little bit Don Martin from Mad Magazine, if you're a Mad fan. He also, as a 17-year-old kid, wrote a children's book called The Giant's Leg, which he submitted to Disney. And if you go to the gallery, you can see his letter of submission and their letter of rejection, saying that, recognizing the timid talents, a very nice letter, as Jenny's often pointed out, and point out that it's, his work is too much like Dr. Seuss, which was a big influence, and it's true criticism. CalArts sketchbooks are also in the exhibition. As I said, we're in the Juvenilia, surviving Burbank area. He studied traditional art history. He took art courses. That's why we put in the exhibition some of his class notebooks with his notes on post-impressionism. And now we move on to this is the first stuff that we saw. When we were beginning research on Tim, we thought, well, most of the show is going to be drawn from the studio archives, not realizing that he had so much material that he had never shown anyone. We went to Pixar, our friends at Pixar, and in their archive they had some photocopies of some of these cartoons. I'm not sure what's next. Here's another one that he had done. That was the first clue. Luckily, we found all of them in Tim's archive. He did about 55 of these. This is in the early 80s, 84 to 86, roughly. He was bored. They're on Animation registration paper. When he was supposed to be animating, he did these to entertain the other animators, and they passed them around the animation room. The other animators who saw the show remarked on the fact that they recalled Tim doing this. Again, they're the perfect combination of the youth study of humor and horror. They emerges them. Another example of that. For some people, these are their favorite things in the whole exhibition. Certainly not one of our favorites. Also, the exhibition contains a lot of unrealized projects. The other thing about Tim was, another one of the motifs is his interest in creativity. As I've said, one of the constant themes in all Tim's work is most of Tim's heroes are artists, essentially artists. If you think about it, they're people who have who turn to the creativity, their creative abilities as a recourse to whatever stressful situation they're in, or as a recourse to disappointments that they turn. Even Sweeney Todd is a guy who loses everything and then builds this big business where he kills people and makes pies and makes a lot of money and is a huge success. Or Edward Scissorhands, he's a sculptor basically, and he goes and sculpts. That's why Tim is essentially optimistic. I think that's one of the keys to why people like him so much. There's an optimism to Tim's work. His characters are optimistic. Ed Wood makes bad films, but he keeps making them. He's never discouraged, and they're a consolation to him, just as Tim turned to creativity and to art as a child. This is from an unrealized project called Dream Factory. So in this period, while he was at CalArts, and before he'd made his first shorts, he just came up with idea after idea and would do an elaborate artwork, concept art for the show. This is his view of what it was like to be an animator, clearly based on his experiences at Disney. Romeo and Juliet. Romeo was a landmass. Juliet is an ocean mass. That was his take on it. These are films that were never made, or projects that were never made. This is a piece of art from Superman Lives. After Batman, he had a big project to do Superman Lives, Superman with Nicolas Cage. It would have been a very different Superman. It would have been a variation on the way he used Michael Keaton. It would definitely not have been a Christopher Reeve Superman. They got very far into pre-production, and the studio canceled it. Tim was very disappointed. Black Cauldron, a very important key work in Tim's career. Black Cauldron was made by Disney. This is work Tim did at Disney when he was an animator. First, they had him animating cute little characters. That didn't work. He didn't like it. He wasn't good at it. They said, "You're an idea man. You'll do ideas for us." So he created, as I said, creativity. All these ideas. He created almost 350 or more drawings for a film called Black Cauldron that was made and released. Not a single one of Tim's drawings was used. They were all like this. This is 83. We're talking about this. It just didn't seem like Disney take on things. If you see in the exhibition, one of the things is a weapon. It's actually shoots infants as weapons. So they said Tim's reportedly an executive said of Tim's work in the period. I haven't actually found this to be 100% the case, that his work looked like roadkill. And when you see something like this, some of the black cauldron art, that's if it, that applies to anything that he did, it probably applies most to the black cauldron stuff. But Tim was incredibly versatile, and he could do a project. His Trick or Treat was another project that came very close to being produced as a stop-motion film, and a lot of what you see in Edward Scissorhands and Nightmare Before Christmas comes from this. This is a very seminal piece, Nightmare Before, Trick or Treat. We could have done a whole show on Trick or Treat, I think. This is art for Trick or Treat, but if you've seen Edward Scissorhands, clearly you see this is the dinner scene when Ed was eating the, trying to eat the peas. It's the actual, the set design is the same. These actually, these utensils are on the wall on that set. So that's an unrealized project, the Trick or Treat project. Trick or Treat is another project set in Burbank. So the Burbank motif is one of the motifs in Tim's work. This small town motif, you see it repeated. Even something like Nightmare Before Christmas is a Burbank film in my mind. It's a character who's unhappy where he is and looks for some other world to be in, be part of. It's a Burbank escape fantasy. Scissorhands is clearly a Burbank. That neighborhood at the bottom is Burbank and the horror house on the hill. Jane talked about Hansel and Gretel, Tim's Hansel and Gretel. Tim conceived Hansel and Gretel as with an all-Asian cast, part drag, ending with a martial arts battle and a paintball fight. And that's why the Disney executives report at the screening, and we've been in touch with the four actors in the film, one we haven't reached, but they reported that when the studio executives saw it at the first screening, they were a little bit disturbed by it. And that's why, as Jenny said, it only showed once, reportedly late in the night, and then disappeared forever. Tim did incredible concept art. This is a concept piece for the paintball sequence at the end. He designed the toys that are in the film. This piece is actually on the wall upstairs, the actual prop from the film. It was a very handmade film. They made all the props. They painted the sets themselves. I'm very, very fond of this piece. Again, concept art for Vincent. And Tim, Jenny's talk spoken about these. Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Squash and stretch, body modification. You can see all those themes in these pieces. Body mod, there it is again, that sense of people being cut up and severed. And there's a psychological aspect to that. There's also a his concept for his original drawing for Batman. Tim says that all his drawings, Jim jokes, all his drawings look the same. And what he means by that is that when he starts to conceive a character, one of the other major motifs in his work that we've identified is creature-based notions of character. In other words, all his characters are, in a sense, creatures looking, when he conceives of it, he looks for the creature, the monster inside his characters. Another thing that, I mean, everybody thinks they're crazy. I mean, most of us think we have some kind of hidden creature inside of it. It's another reason why people like Tim's work. So he looks, his sense of Batman is, this is a Batman that's got something going on inside. The Batman cowls that are in this, this is how they appear to us in Tim's archive when we first saw them. And the sense of, another motif is armoring and masking throughout Tim's work. Characters are when wearing masks are armored in some way or another. Even the Angora sweater from Ed Wood is a kind of armor. That's why we have an armor masking platform upstairs in the gallery. And we try to organize the exhibition around the motifs. So there is a narrative that takes you from surviving Burbank, beautifying Burbank, beyond Burbank being the period of collaborations. But there's also these motifs and that you should see because we organize the show around that. The most obvious one motif piece in the show is the armoring and masking platform. So we could have chosen heroic, restored versions of the headgear. These, the ones that Tim has from the originally used in the film, look more like Tim and more like the concept in that drawing that you saw earlier. So we did not choose heroic versions. Same with the Catwoman suit. You'll notice the Catwoman suit we have is one that's suffering some degree of disrepair and disintegration. And we chose that. The original Catwoman suit has been restored. One of the original Catwoman suits has been restored. Showed at the Met recently. It's very shiny and bright. It's on a mannequin. We chose one that looks more like shed skin. That's more in the spirit of how Tim created it. And it's more to do with what I said about not creating a show that was about the films. If I was doing a moving, the kind of show you might do for a Museum of the Moving Image, I might have chosen heroic versions of the costumes. We're trying to do a show that was about the artistic, the art of Tim's art and the motifs that he resorts to as an artist. So we would choose these kinds of pieces rather than another kind of piece. The exhibition is touring to a number of other venues, and it's going to Australia, and there it's going to Museum of the Moving Image. And it's been interesting to talk to them because they have a different take on how the thing should be exhibited in the selection process. And if I had a sense that the show was going to be touring, I might have chosen other kinds of pieces. It'd be interesting to see how they adapt our exhibition to theirs. Edward Scissorhands' concept art. And the final piece, costume that's in the exhibition with the hands done by Stan Winston. I didn't want the head. Head is part of the mannequin. I was trying to get it cut off because I didn't. I wanted it to have more of a more abstract. This is a good anecdote of what I was just saying. I would have preferred to have it without a head because it would have been more abstract and it would have addressed the issue of armoring and masking without being distractingly about Johnny Depp. The Museum is the Moving Image. Are hopefully going to have a different version of this costume. We lost access to this particular costume, and the one they're going to get does not have a head. They're very upset that they're not having a head because they want a head. Because for Museum of the Moving Image, the head part of it makes more sense. It's ironic. Colleen Atwood costume. This is in the Beyond Burbank section, and that actually is how it looked when it was at the Stan Winston archive. That's why there are toys. But this is not how it looks in our show. But they have it with a head because they had, it was that kind of an exhibition. Concept art, we're now in the period of Beyond Burbank. Pumpkin, there's carnivalesque aspects to this. There's the Burbank theme in this, the theme of alienation from your environment. Original puppets from the Disney studio. I'm about out of time, so I'm going to go through these faster. Tim's original drawings, and then the puppets realized by his collaborators. So now we're going into the period of collaboration. These characters, Tim's drawing, concept drawing, the character designs were by the Grangell Studio. The puppets were created by McKinnon and Saunders. Excuse me. Vincent Marquette, against the influence of the horror films, the Carnivalesque from Big Fish. This is a Colleen Atwood costume design. Tim's other projects include writing. Tim is also a writer, though that's not something he acknowledges a lot, but he writes in verse, and he does contribute to all his scripts in the sense that Edward, Nightmare Before Christmas is a verse poem. Edward Scissorhands, there were verse explanation if it wasn't just an image that inspired it. And he did this Melancholy Death of Oyster Boy that then became the Stain Boy stories and became a line of toys that he did, Unrealized Children's Book Project. Creature-based notions of character, which go back to, if you know the Rat Fink character from the 60s. I saw Tim as a pop surrealist, as an artist. I attempt to look at Tim as an artist. If you look at Tim, not as a filmmaker, but as an artist, where would he be? And I saw him as belonging to that tradition of the pop surrealist. This is a Southern California guy, that tradition of pop surrealist artists, lowbrow artists, as they're called. This is one of his desk blotters. Who deal with a lot of the same motifs. His Polaroids are in the Titus 1 and 2 lobby, and again, there are these same motifs, stripes. There's a carnival quality to this, creature quality to this. The puppets from Nightmare Before Christmas, which he's photographed, is at zero. The film's journey is already gone through. More of the installation piece that Tim created. This is a family unit. And once again, creature-based notions of character. This is the juvenilia section, as I'm sure you know. These were three pieces created for the exhibition when he saw that we selected the art that these are based on. These are based on drawings he did in the for a project, I think, around 1982. And it's a family. The child is the big one. The mother is the small one in the middle. And the father is the one here on the right. That's that. Tim explained that to us. And Tim came in and helped us position these. Here is Tim positioning the robot boy piece. This was a piece created for the show by Tim based on the character that was introduced in the Melancholy Death of Oyster Boy. Appears in the Stain Boy web series that you see in the hall. And then as another iteration, as a theme and motif, as a as one of the new pieces he created for the show. Creature-based notions of character, body modification, all these themes you can see in it. Even the sense of a sideshow attraction, the carnivalesque aspect of Tim's work. These are the pieces when they were being built. There's the Balloon Boy, and it's in Los Angeles.
His typeface.
I don't believe he has. No, I mean, Tim doesn't have gallery representative. There's no one. You can't buy his art. He's not selling it anywhere except reproductions. He created this commercial for us, which is in the main lobby. As you know, it's a stop-motion commercial created by McKinnon and Saunders. So we actually got to collaborate with the same people that Tim collaborated with, the museum did, when we were creating this. So this is the character that he created that's in that video that you see. It's a stop-motion character. That piece is a stop-motion and CGI film. This was storyboarded. All right, I think it's time for questions, if you have any.
Excuse me for leaving.
Yeah.
I have to ask questions.
Yeah.
I have read or heard that he didn't think he could draw, or someone told him he couldn't draw, and decided that that was the beginning of a new attack for him. Is that true? Did he talk about that?
He talked about someone telling him to draw whatever he wanted to draw. He had one teacher, this is a famous story. He had one teacher in school that said, "You're a great drawer, you should keep drawing, and even though your stuff may be strange." One person, someone who encouraged him, actually. When he was trying to be professional, early in his career, they were telling him, "Your drawing is not good, it's not going to work. This, you know, we can't do this in three dimensions, this is not Disney enough for us." You know, Tim was just ahead of his time that way. Now, you know, everyone's trying to be Tim Burton. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't get to that. There's none on the exhibit. You know, when he did Trick or Treat, he was at Disney. He said, "I want to make this a stop motion film." He would do it. We'd draw the piece. For instance, the battle, the True Love pieces, the two Transformer toys that are fighting in the gallery. They said it's too two-dimensional. It's never going to work in 3D. So he got his friend from CalArts, Rick Heinrich, who was a sculptor, to sculpt them in three dimensions to prove to the studio they were wrong. And Rick is still doing that. Rick sculpted some of the pieces that you see with a new commission piece that Tim did for us. So that's Rick did them.
The second part, too short. I would like to see more of this work, more than the way they do the monsters or the figures. More. Because the first part, it was a description of all the movies. We know the movies. Everybody here knows all these movies. So I would like to have more of your part.
Oh, well, I don't say that to Jenny's here. You have to. Well, I was unfair. See, I'm the senior curator, so I said I want to do the interesting part, and Jenny did the films. But yeah, I mean, thanks. It's great to know you want more. I mean, that's nice to hear. I understand. Well, ask me questions, and I'll tell you more. But Jenny will tell you more. She knows as much about the second part as I do. I just got to present it. Anyone else? Yeah.
When there are live action sequences and people like Michael Keaton and all that, does Tim Burton have any direct contact with those actors?
Oh yeah, you want to? Sure. I mean, Tim works as a live action director. Yeah, fully.
Yeah, and so he tells them what to do, and so keeps them in line with his thought process. The actors didn't put anything on their own.
Do you know about that? Yeah, I think they definitely. Oh, Johnny Depp certainly does. I mean, definitely collaborate. That's why he works with the same people, you know, people like Johnny Depp, because they're kind of his muse, and it's easier for him to communicate with them. But yeah, I mean, actually, I would actually say Tim is probably more hands-on with the live-action films than he is with the stop-motion films, because other people make the puppets and other people direct them. You know, Henry Selick directed Nightmare, and Mike Johnson directed Corpse Bride. So, I mean, he consults more with them. Yeah.
Relationship did he have with his parents? And did he have
sisters
or brothers? He has one
brother. His parents, he had an alienated relationship from his parents. He left home, moved in with his grandmother because he didn't like living at home. He says that his parents walled him into his room and closed his windows up, which I think is he made up, but that's what he claims. But yeah, his grandmother lived a few blocks away.
How old was he when he moved out to this family?
15 or 16, you think? Around that? Yeah. 15, 16, 17.
So they didn't really get him.
No, although as you see in the exhibition, he worked with it. He did drawings for his father's The Employee's Newsletter. He was in the Police Youth Band, so he was not totally alienated. He was part of that.
Trying to be.
Yeah, he tried to be. Just, you know.
Well, he was very close with his father, and His father passed away around the time that Big Fish was released in 2003. And if you remember Big Fish, it was especially poignant for Tim because it dealt with kind of this father-son redemption. And that is another reason why, you know, you'll see that in his films a lot, it kind of this father figure, son, kind of this, you know, tug and pull.
Right.
There a lot. His work, his drawings, his films, all of his work is very personal. About 70% of the exhibition had never been seen by the public before. These projects were made, like the photographs, they're personal projects, and like the cartoons, they're private projects made for his friends and his colleagues. And so, in his even in his public work, there's a lot of personal, emotional overtones that you'll see.
Yeah, there's a motif I didn't mention, one of the major motifs of his work I didn't mention in the first part because I, you know, was the relationship between childhood and adulthood. To me, that's, to me, the creative, the fact that his artists, most of his major characters are creative people. And the second major theme of all, every single film he makes is this relationship between childhood and adulthood, characters, adults who are more like children and children who are more like adults, and the dialogue, not only a dialogue, but how as an adult your childhood personality is surviving, you nurture it or don't nurture it, and how as a child, you know, your personality reflects the future. I mean, that's what his characters are like. Yeah, yeah.
When Nightmare Before Christmas came out, it wasn't necessarily this, you know, massive hit, and it's kind of become, years later now, kind of like the hot topic, symbol of kind of teenage angst and outcastedness, and you kind of see Jack Skellington on everything now, years later. Why do you think that? Do you have any insight into kind of why that picked up much later on?
I don't know. It's a franchise, that movie Before Christmas, right? They come back every year. This product, it's too much. It's like The Simpsons, you know.
But it disappeared for like 10 years.
Yeah, Jenny, do you want
to? Again, Nightmare Before Christmas is a very personal project for Tim. He had been working on it for decades. The story and the characters, for decades before it came out. He didn't have financing to make it until the success of Batman and the fact that he proved that he was a bankable director. And he finally had enough clout to hire Henry Selick to produce, to make Skellington Productions. And it was you know, more or less a four-year process. Henry Selick and Skellington Productions was, you know, up in the Bay Area making this film, giving Tim the opportunity to direct live-action movies like Ed Wood while the stop-motion animation was being produced. So it's a very personal project for Tim. And I think what you're talking about in terms of identification, you see that in a lot of Tim's films, which is why sometimes he's termed a cult director, because, you know, his themes are universal. They're not remote or esoteric. People can identify with these themes, even though he places them in characters that are completely, you know, out there and completely unexpected. But you know, at their core, the alienation, kind of, you know, being bullied and wanting to be something better than you know you are. I mean, Jack Skellington is the king of Halloween Town, but he's basically, you know, sort of this manic depressive anti-hero. And I think everybody can identify to some portion of that. And you can identify with Sally and his other characters that he put so much into. Just as a side note, the development for Sally took part in his photograph project. So he did this Blue Girl series, and using that kind of personal private project, he was able to develop this other character. So there are all these interconnections between the art and the films. So they're not really separate projects, even though one might be public and one might be private. At the core of it, it's created by Tim. And no matter the medium, film or paper, it's the emotion that you connect with, and it's the subjective part of the work that you connect with.
Is his art a catalyst for the films always, or for his creed, for the animations? Or does it come later, or how is that?
The art always comes first.
Art always comes first.
Yeah, when he conceives the character, he does those drawings. When I see someone wearing a Skellington stuff, I think of that creature-based. Everyone thinks they have a creature. It's like saying, I'm a creature. I have this creature inside of me, and that's
so
the Skellington symbols.
Does that have his progression all the time? Does he always work in that process?
Yeah, he begins by conceiving the characters on little sketchbooks. He does lots of sketches. That's, you know, virtually every project we looked at, lots of concept work, particularly in the earlier stuff.
In the live action,
stop motion, both. He's still, there's only a few pieces of Alice in the exhibition intentionally. We didn't want the shirt about Alice. We could have chosen a few more pieces. But, yeah, this is drawings from Alice in there. Yeah.
Why did 3D, why did he adopt 3D? It just seems so, I don't know.
The 3D is, this is, Alice is, well, I mean, I like the 3D. Personally, I like 3D, but, I mean, this doesn't feel like it, in some ways, Alice doesn't feel as much like a Tim Burton film. The best parts of it are the motifs, the heads and all that stuff. The thing, that's what I like the best about it. It's not a Tim Burton story. The female empowerment story is not a Burton story, you know, personally. And it's also it's a CGI film, and he doesn't do CGI films. So in many ways, it's different. I mean, I enjoyed Alice, but I had mixed feelings about it. But yeah, I mean, I know what you're talking about, the 3D.
I'm just curious if you think he's going to adopt more 3D in his...
Well, Tim loves 3D. He loves the visual. He loves it. He was cool to do 3D. He'd love to do so he liked that part of it, appealed to him. I mean, whether it's perfect for him. And, you know, the film is available in 2D, and some people say it's just as good in 2D as 3D. I haven't seen it in 2D.
Lassiter and Burton friends.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's friends with all those. You know, John Lasseter, Rick Heinrich, when I mentioned the sculptor. Danny Elfman came from CalArts. CalArts is the center of... And they all went on to Disney, and then they all, you know, went on to in different ways.
Do you know why he chooses not to market any of his work?
He's not a gallery artist. He never considered himself a gallery artist. And when he came to our show, Jenny will attest, he walked through parts of the show going like this. Like, I can't look at that. I was juvenile. I was a little kid. I can't, Hansel and Gretel, I can't look at it, he said. I can't look at it. It embarrasses me, you know. And to us, it has all those motifs, the Carnivalesque motif. You can see Beetlejuice in it, and you can see Sweeney Todd. Sweeney Todd and Hansel and Gretel both end with someone getting pushed in an oven. And the oven looks the same, pretty much, from film to film. One's a horror film, one's a comedy, such as it is. Tim? I really don't think he's shy. Do you think he's shy? Self-effacing? He's very self-effacing. Well, with us, I mean, yeah, he's really nice. I mean, he's a rock star, so he gets barraged with people. So when too many people want your attention, you become kind of the way he is. But when you're working with him one-to-one, I mean, we had the experience of doing that. It was great, because we had all his attention. He sat with us. He took us to dinner. He invited us to go to his house and look at what he has in his living room, because we brought a couple of pieces from his living room into the exhibition. So our relationship with him was kind of really special and cool. But yeah, one-on-one, he's just very down-to-earth. He's a guy from, you know, a kid from Burbank, basically. I mean, that's the way he feels.
With a lot of the paper seemed bent. Was it crammed into a drawer? I felt like things were crammed into drawers or something, and you pulled them out. And how were they archived? Did he have an archive of his earlier work?
Yeah, I think they were crammed into drawers probably for years, but now he's archiving them. He has an archivist who's digitizing everything, and they're cataloging it, and we're going through the process of how big is this piece? How many inches is it? What is it? Pencil? Is it crayon? Is it magic marker? What is it? Because we had 550 pieces, and that's hard. Because if you do hang a show of Monets, you know what the size, you know, and everything about them, you need to know what the conservation issues are. If you do stuff, new stuff, every single piece is a problem.
You did a great job.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. I just had one quick question. In addition to what you said earlier about sort of having a sympathetic to the abnormal as a theme in some of this work, in a number of his films, he seems to have a really scathing criticism of what is normal. Like, the vast majority of people who are not abnormal in his films are portrayed as stupid or manipulative. Like, there's a rare character that the character empathizes with that's like a special person who might have a relationship with, but the majority of people are really negative.
The film you get the greatest insight into his sense of humor and personality and political views is Mars Attacks. So look at Mars Attacks, which is a critique of politicians, the military, the media, I mean, all the usual. That, you know, as Jenny said, you know, Independence Day was the hit because it was a kind of a right-wing, gung-ho, we're going to kill everybody film. And Tim's was this social criticism film about making fun of all the things that, you know, the other film was building up. So Independence Day was building up. So, I mean, his assistant said, Mars Attacks is Tim. That's Tim. You know, it's very Southern California. It's the pop surrealist Tim. It's the bright-colored film. You know, there's the gothic Tim, and there's the pop surrealist film. There's the Mars Attacks, Charlie and Chocolate Factory Tim, and the Corpse Bride Sweeney Todd, Nightmare Tim.
It is a psychological critique of Hemingway that Hemingway didn't want to cooperate with instead of full nonsense. It was a psychological treatment of many different artists. Olivia's Mask, for example. Is there any chance of a psychological book coming out about things that move Tim Burton that he might not even know about? Or is there an opportunity to think of someone from your people with weight talking to him about writing like Hemingway's movable piece, you know, something that's very, very personal and that lays out what he's thinking firsthand?
Well, you won't get it from him because he doesn't like to talk about himself. Like he told us, do the show, but don't ask me what it means. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to organize. He didn't intrude on us. Some people thought he controlled it. He didn't want anything to do with it. He looked at what he asked us why we put some things in. You know, why are you putting this children's stuff, this kid stuff in? This is, but he didn't. I mean, he's so someone else would have to do that. Someone else is going to do it. People will be doing it, but it won't
someone
be
would
him.
Someone have to have this cooperation. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about somebody who's qualified, you know, to talk to him, to make things clear firsthand, so people aren't interpreting what he meant.
Well, he does. He has done a lot of interviews, so you can hear him speak firsthand on his movies, not necessarily his. Burton on Burton is a series of interviews that Mark Salisbury did with Tim. And, you know, Tim won't say, if you read it, you know, it's not a direct response or kind of a concrete confirmation of what people have said about Tim, but it does give you a little kind of insight into like what Tim likes and how he's feeling during certain things. And there are some candid anecdotes from his filmmaking. And he does touch upon his art and why he did a certain piece of art at a time. So that exists.
We have to wrap it up, but you read what the artist says, and then you don't have to believe him necessarily. And we didn't, you know, I don't agree with, for instance, Boonwell is always saying things. I said, that's not true. Boonwell worked here, and he said things about what he did when he was here, and I said, that's not true. He's not misremembering it, or he's lying. So, and Tim, you know, we were telling Tim things that he would say, I wouldn't say that about myself, but, you know, it's nice. It's nice when you have, to be able to do, that's why we have museums, that's why you do exhibitions, so that the curators can give a different perspective and the audiences either buy it or don't buy it, and you get engaged. And apparently Burton really engaged people, and we're really happy about that. So thanks for coming. Thank you.